flat cap.
Naked lycra, uncovered lycra. Lycra without a baggie over it does not help anyone.
Does mountain biking have an image problem?
Not really, but it doesn't really have enough of an image to have a problem.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's Single Track World podcast. I'm Hannah, and this week we have Mark.
Hello.
And Charlie.
Hello.
And Chips.
Hello.
They all sound quite like a second or two pause there, so let's hope they're awake. Mark, you could be excused, Mark, for being a little bit slow because you might still have jet lag. You're a sensitive soul, and you've been far away. Tell us about where you've been.
Well, it's I've now been back in the UK for well over a week, so any jet lag I should have got over, but I haven't. For some reason, I keep falling asleep at 8 o'clock at night, and then waking up wide awake at like 11 o'clock and can't get to sleep. For some reason, it's lingering. Anyway, I've been to Utah in the United States of America. Mm. It was for a bike launch, which I cannot tell you about.
Okay.
Until January the 24th.
Okay.
But while I was there, I did get to do quite a bit of riding. Mind you, quite a bit, 2 days of riding, but we did cover quite a lot of ground in that time. It was an e-bike I was riding.
And whereabouts in Utah were you?
It was only just in Utah. I actually flew into Las Vegas, and then it was 2 hours out of Utah. Apparently, we drove very briefly through Arizona and then into the bottom left-hand corner of Utah and a place called, and it's completely escaped my brain.
St. George?
You're right, near St. George, and the resort is Red Mountain Resort. That's it.
So you're basically on the doorstep of where they have Rampage, weren't you?
That's right, yes, in the same kind of geographical area. I think we rode about 15 miles away from where Rampage this year took place.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So it's going to be like a huge travel, like downhill fork e-bike thing that you could beast your way up to the top of the cliffs and then flip your way down. Yeah? Is that what you were doing?
That's not at all what we were doing.
Come on, it's called the Huxtable, isn't it?
There was definitely no middle-aged rampage going on in my riding.
Very
There's always a middle-aged rampage with you, Mark.
Well, yes, I guess. No, I honestly cannot tell you about the bike I was riding, but we had a great time. The trails were absolutely amazing. We rode double black trails, and none of them were anywhere close to being anything that you'd recognise in Rampage. It was all wheels on the ground, rocky, technical, very slabby, not a lot of flow, to be honest, because it was so technical all the way around, and the views were outstanding. I've never experienced terrain like that before. I've ridden over in the US a few times. I've ridden close to there, in fact. I've ridden in Park City, which is a bit like where we were riding, but with trees.
It's the other end of Utah Park City, isn't it? So it's like a whole pile of elevation up, and it's like a ski resort as well. So it has green stuff and mountains and trees. But where you were is more like big red lumps of rock, isn't it?
And lava. Yeah, not hot lava, dead lava, but there's lava fields, and it was very desert-like. So, but it was actually, bizarrely, it was freezing cold. It was actually daytime temperatures around freezing. And which is weird because it was super blue sky and really strong sun. And at one point I stood in the sunlight and I stood with my leg behind a wall. So it was in the shade and my leg got really, really cold because it was out of the sun. So yeah, it was really cool. But it was, I'm used to the cold. I like the cold.
That doesn't quite cut it for the sympathy. You don't get sympathy for that.
What? I had a cold leg, Charlie.
It's November.
One cold leg.
The drizzle is drifting knee deep outside right now.
Yep.
And you're in sunshine. I don't care how cold your sunshine was.
Oh, dear. But the riding was spectacular. I have to say, it was 2 days there. So it was a 10.5-hour flight out, a 2-hour transfer, and then 2 days in the resort, and then the same thing coming back. And I have to say, on balance, I mean, the travelling was awful. The way out, I had a guy. I was in the window seat on the plane. I had a guy in the middle seat who had a very different definition of personal space to my own, and it was horrible. However, the riding made up for it. I would certainly go back there and ride for 2 days and suffer the long haul travel because it was that good.
You normally avoid flying like a plague as well, so it must have been good riding.
It was, like I said, I would definitely go back and do that again, even if it was just for a couple of days. It was well worth the trip, despite, you know, it all being in, it was Mormon country. So that was interesting experience.
You have to plan your alcohol purchases much more carefully.
You do indeed. In fact, a lot, we've got some really good tips from some of the guides. For example, one of our guides was saying that it's actually illegal to import alcohol across the state line. So if you're in Utah, you can't order drinks and have them delivered. You can't order alcohol and have it delivered through the post across the state line, which makes it a bit of a problem for people who have, you know, joined beer clubs. But the son of the guide said that they have this clever workaround. I hope I'm not going to drop anybody in trouble here or get people arrested. But
even on he's a podcast, shush.
But his son is a member of a beer club. It'd be like Beer 52. Charlie, you can tell us about Beer 52 later because I do believe we've still got an offer on for our readers, haven't we, on Beer 52? What a marketing segue that was. That was genius, wasn't it?
If only I could remember the discount code, that'd be brilliant.
If only I had any of the beer here, it'd be even more brilliant.
I think there's some beer in the office. There's some beer in the office. Yeah, well,
I'm not in the office. And I have.
Anyway, I was telling you a story.
You got some...
Yes, so this person in Utah is a member of a beer club, a bit like Beer 52, but he's actually instructed the beer club to not actually label the boxes when they get delivered to him, and instead he said, please can you label up all the boxes as snow globes and declare them as snow globes. So he is now Utah's premier importer of snow globes. So that's how you do it, folks, if you're living in Utah and you want to get a beer.
I think I'm still a member of a members club in Moab. If you're in a restaurant, you're allowed a beer with your meal, but then the second you stop eating, they can't serve you any more beer, and they can't bring a second beer to you while you're still finishing the first beer. And great rules like that. So I went out and I went to there was this sort of club. That looked like it was a good place to go and people were having fun there. And there was a queue outside and there was a bouncer and people were coming up and he was going, are you a member? Yes. Oh, well, $2 in you come. Are you a member? Yes, $2. And then I turned up and he's like, are you a member? Like, no. And he went, guy over there in the stripy shirt, that's Ted. He signed you in, all right, if the police turn up. So that'd be $2. So I'm now a member.
Sounds like the blue pig.
So, in the off license, on the way in into the off-licence in Moab, there's a sign. I've actually got a picture of it here on my phone. So it says, notice to minors, no one under the age of 21 is permitted to enter this store unless accompanied by parent or spouse of legal age.
Do you have to bring your gun in with you to buy alcohol?
No. Is it just the one spouse?
There's a good chance that you have a spouse before you're allowed to buy beer. So.
My second big impression when I landed in America for the first time. One was, damn, everything's really American. You know, that's the thing with America. Everything looks really American and just like the movies. And we went straight to a liquor store in Phoenix and there was a big sign telling me not to bring my gun in. And it's, oh, yeah, this is really American now. They had a whole aisle of IPAs, including all-day IPA, which is intended only is sold by the case and intended for all-day drinking. It's a brilliant product.
I like the sound of that. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. The trip was amazing. I did go there expecting that we might be getting a bit of rampage action, you know, proper, what people might think is proper mountain biking, but I didn't. It was all wheels on the ground. It was super spectacular stuff. And while I was over there riding that, what were you doing, Hannah?
I was giving a talk in Sheffield. Yeah.
Nice. What was your talk about?
Short straw. Well, so Ride Sheffield, with the assistance of Manon Carpenter, had organised an event about reframing mountain biking. And it was, what is Charlie doing?
I was just holding up something that says Seg No Way.
Okay. Did you not like my segue then,
no,
Charlie?
It's brilliant. It's like, no way, that's seamless. I've just ruined it.
It's too distracting. Event called Reframing Mountain Biking. And so it was looking at how we can improve access to our trails, and how we can broaden the number and type of people that are doing mountain biking as well.
And who goes to that? Who was in the audience?
So it was their first kind of event of this style, and so they kept it fairly small. So there was some media people there, some trail associations, but not all trail associations, just some, and some people from the Cycling UK, Natural Resources Wales, Forestry, I'm not sure it was Forestry Commission, Forestry Land Scotland, something like that. Kind of a mix of people. And there were a few like guides, coaching type people there as well. So I was asked to talk about image and mountain biking as my bit. So different people gave different presentations. So there was some presentations on diversity and inclusivity. And then there was mine on image, or me and another guy from, I think, Natural Resources Wales, who did image and mountain biking. And we had two from two trail associations as well.
People might be mistaken for thinking this all sounds a bit academic and dry, but afterwards you actually wrote up a story and you published it on the website. It's a members-only story, so you have to be sort of subscribed to be able to read it. But despite that, it's gone off the chart in terms of people's thoughts and comments on it. I mean, I think it's over 100 comments as of the date of this recording. Mm-hmm. So it's gone a bit ballistic. I mean, it seems to be the discussion is on the website seems to be concentrating on how, I'm going to see if I can sum it up and then you can explain if this is the case, Hannah. It seems to be about the fact that the public perception outside of our community of mountain biking, so like the normal people, it seems to be their perception of mountain biking might be tainted by a lot of the marketing, and that people think of it as something that's a bit extreme, whereas what we know that what we do week in, week out can mostly be sort of categorised as bridleway bimbling, which is what I think, and I think that's pretty typical. I think 95% of mountain biking is mostly bimbling with your mates rather than doing anything extreme. Would you say that characterises what's going on in the discussion, Hannah?
Yeah, so that was kind of my thesis, was that people who don't ride mountain bikes, what do they see? What do they know about mountain biking? So I kind of went through different news sources, because people who don't know about mountain biking are not reading Single Track. Let's face it. So I looked at like Google News results and The Guardian, which is kind of broadly pro-cycling, and to see what kind of stories you might get. And everything that you find is either about injury or it's just not there. Like, there is a tiny amount of news coverage about mountain biking in the general broad of press. So it kind of struck me that, well, if what you think is, oh, it's scary and it's likely to cause you an injury, then you're hardly likely to write into your local council when they do a consultation on building a new trail centre instead of a golf course or something and go, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Like, I want my kid to do that. Because your idea of what it is skewed from the reality.
I mean, that brings up a bit of a question or two that's come up in those comments. I've got it actually open in front of me, so I'm just reading through this. But a couple of people on there have said, look, you know, if people who aren't mountain bikers perceive mountain biking as something else, does that actually matter to us because we just go out and do it? Why is it important to change the public perception of mountain biking?
Well, so it kind of, there's two elements, I think two elements to it, maybe more. There's one is that there's a lot of riders at the moment pushing for the kind of trail association model to, where they take over what is currently called wild trails or cheeky trails, like stuff that's been dug in the woods, that's enduro fit stuff. And when they are trying to get that turned legit, they come up against land managers who are really scared about having people injured on these trails and on their land and the liability for it and all that kind of thing. And you also get people who are sharing those woodlands and hillsides with us, like dog walkers or whatever, or horse riders, saying, oh, well, I don't like mountain bikers because they scare my horse, they hurt my dog, whatever. So when it comes to advancing that kind of more advanced end of the sport, you hit opposition because people are scared of mountain biking. And then when you look at the more like entry level end of the sport, it's not accessible to a large number of people because there aren't bridleways or there aren't trails, marked trails for people like in urban areas particularly to go and access. So that kind of mass of the population who might either get into mountain biking and then become those advanced riders of the future, or get into mountain biking and just think, yeah, mountain biking's a good thing and it's good for me. Like, they don't have the opportunity to discover it, and they're not seeing it in the press as being a thing that you might go and try, like you see other sports as being a thing that you might go and try, or other activities, I would call it, as a thing. So
there's a lot of parallels have been drawn in that article and in the discussion with other sports. And Charlie, you've got a bit of insight into some of these so-called other sports, don't you?
Other sports.
What else is
the
there?
The ones that aren't football.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I started off riding off-road in 1979 before we even knew the word mountain bike. In my little neighbourhood in the woods, and I've been skateboarding since 77, and that led on to surfing. And skateboarding and surfing are massive industries now, big business. When I started 30-something years ago surfing, there was one or two surf schools in Cornwall. Now there's two or three on every beach. And it's... Surfing was started off as a subculture, and it was glamorous, dangerous, beach bums and beatniks. If it wasn't cool, the Beach Boys wouldn't have pretended to be surfers. The Beach Boys couldn't surf.
What's a beatnik? Exactly.
It's me in a beret. Beatniks is kind of that jive-talking, pre-hippie, art-loving beret-wearing early 60s and 50s kind of art, kind of hipster. Ah, hipster. That's what they are. They're just hipsters. the original hipsters. Sorry.
Proto-hipsters.
And so the Beach Boys didn't even surf. But they built a whole career on surfing, which proves that it is something that was desirable and cool and merchantizable or marketable right from the very beginning. And skateboarding's been the same thing. But the roots of surfing and skateboarding are beach bums, drugs. It's the bad boy image. And it's always gone against it. But I think surfing and skateboarding have been around longer than mountain biking. And we got to a point where the kids who were skateboarding in the 70s and the guys who were surfing in the 60s and 70s were now town councillors. And it's moved on. You know, we're old punks and old skaters, and now almost every town has an awesome bit of concrete skate park. Locally, Todd, great. I don't like it, but it's a good skate park. Hebden Bridge, great skate park. You go over the hill, there's another one. Now, these weren't around in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, or the noughties. And I think town councillors have realised that if you give people a sporting facility, they'll use it. And I think the same will happen in time for mountain biking. There's a natural selection that occurs in business. If people can make money out of it, it will happen. If they can't make money out of it, it might happen for a bit of and fade away. And people have figured out that they can make money. Well, not make money. They can keep people quiet, keep the kids quiet by building them skate parks. And Hannah mentioned skiing. We've been talking about this before the podcast. And those ski resorts, they're there because people are making money. And so if we can position mountain biking in a place where people are making money, the cafes making money, the car parks making money, the hotels making money, etc., then the support, the promotion, the publicity will just naturally flow. And if we can support, if as mountain bikers, if we support the people who support us, the guy making bacon butties in the lay-by or whatever, through to the resorts, it will all come together. It's just a matter of time.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, so that's kind of the other bit of what I was saying was like, who can make these good impressions happen? And yes, as riders, we've all got individual responsibilities to be on our best behaviour, portray ourselves as well as possible.
Surfing and skateboarding has always been a badass thing. It's always been a bit gnarly. And not that marketable. When they figured out they can make money out of... Well, what happened is industry figured it could make money out of people looking like a skateboarder, looking like a surfer. So now they're making money out of selling everyone T-shirts and expensive shoes. They portray it as a nice, wholesome thing. And because they portrayed it like that, it has followed. If you paddle out in places... if you go surfing, I go surfing spots I've surfed for 30 years, and now there's children out there. There's now... ladies out there, that didn't happen 10 plus years ago. That was really rare. And it's become much more accessible.
But isn't the difference actually here between what's happened in what you're saying has happened in surfing and skateboarding and mountain biking is the fact that kids take up skateboarding because it's a fun thing to do, but no one's saying that that's extreme and you're going to hurt yourself, and no one's actually pointing out all the injuries. And believe me, I know, and you know, Charlie, that skateboarding, if you really want to get yourself on crutches and into a pot, then skateboarding is probably the most efficient way to go about doing that.
When you were our age, Mark, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Without a doubt. I've stayed lucky. I haven't dislocated a thing for quite some time.
So how is it that an injury-prone sport like skateboarding seems to have a much healthier image, whereas mountain biking, we're saying here, seems to be portrayed as something that's extreme and full of injuries and not being portrayed as something healthy and a good thing to do?
If I can wade in here for a sec, just because by amazing coincidence and not a crowbarred segue, the editorial in the next issue of the magazine happens to touch on this subject, in that mountain biking's always been a sort of individual sport, and it prides itself in the fact that you can just go off into the woods and ride around, and you don't need 10 friends to all be on a paid for pitch on a Sunday morning. But because of that, mountain bikers have never really needed to get together to formalize groups and things. We have a national body, British Cycling, who really only cares about competition, and so that will be.
I got my head bitten off for saying that.
well, that's all they care about.
It's true.
So, and you've got a culture in mountain biking that we don't really need to unionize. And in the UK, we've been very lucky with our sort of historical accidental crowbarring in of bikes in the 1968 Rights of Way Act, where it was like bicycles are allowed on roads, and bridleways. And because of that, we then had our access set in stone. But what we've found in recent years is that a lot of councils don't know who to talk to. The forestry managers don't. There's no local rep for the mountain bikers. There is for the climbers and the walkers and the lovers of the birds and the trees. But mountain bikers, because we're too cool and we don't really need to get together and form a group, the councils will go, right, we've flattened this trail, which was getting a bit bumpy because the horse riders have complained about it. And we asked the local cycle touring club and they said they don't go down that track, so help yourself and make it nice and smooth for everyone to ride. And the mountain bikers suddenly discover that their favorite trail has been bulldozed because the council didn't know who to talk to, and their idea of what is rideable and what people can ride is completely different to what we know is a fun mountain bike trail that's also accessible for other users.
And so, but that puts all of the pressure for like activism and change onto local volunteers rather than there being, because we don't have a national body or a brand-led kind of representative thing. And so this is partly what I was arguing, was that we should see the brands step up and do this different sort of marketing that helps reach. I mean, this is totally shooting myself in the foot, because I'm saying don't spend your money with Singletrack, go and spend your money in advertising in the Telegraph or whatever to brands. But I think to further the interests of mountain biking, that's what we need. And if you look at people like Burton, when they invented snowboards or whatever, or really wanted to sell them, they went out there and like created this whole scene and like did a bunch of marketing and spoke to people outside of the skiers to sell it to the resorts. And Specialized have done it in the US. They have taken Forest Service land managers out on e-bikes because they know that in those areas, it's those specific land managers that have the authority to say whether e-bikes are allowed to ride on their trails or not. And so it is possible for brands to influence stuff from a top-down way. But at the moment, I only see it happening in like little silos and pockets rather than all of those big brands with all that money that they're making out of it trying to get together, instead of a whole bunch of volunteers at local level trying to get together in their spare, you know, couple of hours a week or whatever.
I agree with you, Hannah. I think there's a bit of a mismatch between marketing and the reality when it comes to mountain biking. I think you're right. I think the brands need to probably think about this a little bit more. I'm going to just draw a parallel with snow sports and skiing. So if you think about snowboarding and skiing and the perception of what people think of it, it's certainly, I mean, we've all grown up with Ski Sunday and we've seen all the downhill stuff and all that sort of stuff. So, and we've all grown up in probably the secondary schools where the slightly more well-off kids got to go skiing once a year and things like that. I never got to go on that. I couldn't, yeah. But it's an interesting marketing exercise to compare mountain biking with snowboarding and skiing. The biggest sort of market for snowboarding and skiing isn't the kids, the teenagers doing snowboard drops across pillow fields and in massive powder fields. 99% of all the money in snow sports actually is generated by middle-aged people going on holiday maybe once or twice a year and just cruising down pistes in somewhere in the Alps. That's where the money is. There's a good example of this, which is the Telegraph of all papers has this regular annual ski and snowboard supplement. And they know exactly where the money lies in terms of skiing and snowboarding. It's exactly with their demographic. And whether we like it or not, most of mountain biking is kind of that same clientele, that same market. It's us middle-aged people, because simply put, it's the middle-aged demographic that's got all the cash to be able to drop $5,000 on a mountain bike. And I mean, we've got the luxury of the fact we can ride it from our doorsteps and we don't have to go to the Alps to be able to do it. But it's the marketing. Sorry, I'm just coming in. Cheers, Chips, because that threw me then. The marketing of ski and snowboarding isn't all about there's a lot of extreme out there. You know, you watch Red Bull and they do all the sort of, there's a kind of a equivalent to mountain bike rampage in snowboarding. But most of the marketing or most of the public perception of skiing is what 95% of skiers do, which is just cruising in zigzag lines down a piste, which I think is the equivalent of mountain bikers just going out onto bridleways and going a long way through the countryside. So skiing seems to have got it right. I think biking needs to do something to fix that.
One thing we've got in the UK that's perhaps different to the US and maybe some of the other ski sort of centres is that they're obviously resort-based, whereas we just ride bikes. And because the image of skiing is that very resort-based, very shiny, very, very well photographed image, in the UK, we only really have what people have seen. And for anyone who isn't a cyclist, a bicycle is a toy. It comes, you know, you buy your children toys, and then at some point, they learn to drive and then they stop, you know, playing with toys. And so we are seen by people who don't have much contact with bikes as sort of messing around on these toys. And
being really annoying, worthy eco warriors. That's the other.
Complete opposite of being complete rad, jumping off houses, kind of rad dudes that you see on the TV. And there's no middle ground, because that's not interesting to write about. It's not interesting to see pictures of. And like, there's no, you know, 2.5-star reviews ever. There's either 1-star or 5-star. You know, no one says, well, this is perfectly acceptable. I'm satisfied with my purchase.
But this is the nub of the issue, isn't it? Because the other sports that we're looking at seem to have managed to find a way to market to that middle ground, but mountain biking hasn't. So, I mean, in that discussion on our forum in response to Hannah's article, there's lots of people taking up issue with the word mountain biking, or the words mountain biking. Do we need to call it something different, or is that just throwing the baby out with the bathwater? There's quite a few interesting suggestions on there. Wild cycling, for one. Do we have a name problem?
Well, wild swimming's all the bloody rage now, isn't it? Is it wild swimming? Swimming. It's not wild. You know, wild swimming is swimming in 20-foot waves or over waterfalls. You know, but it's wild swimming. It's just swimming.
But mountain biking, 99% of the time, is not riding on mountains.
No, I've always complained about this. And I think, you know, you're not a mountain biker until you've hit a summit. Even if
that's
it's a summit in Surrey.
That's a very elitist stance to take, Charlie, and I take issue with that.
Well, I'm being quite literal.
You're not helping the argument, Charlie.
Well, and so this is, I guess, why the discussion about the term mountain biking came about, is that, like, if you live in Birmingham, how do you see mountain biking as something for you? Because you're a very long way away from any mountains.
Well, Hannah, the older members of the crew here might remember the times of there was a debate in the cycling press in the 80s. Do we call it ATB or MTB? Is it mountain biking or all-terrain biking? And that was actually a debate when we had a handful of magazines, and many of them only reached issue 5 and stuff like that in the very early days. But was it about 88-ish, 87? That was a thing. Do we call it all-terrain biking or mountain biking?
And there was a perception that mountain bike was copyrighted by Charlie Kelly and Gary Fisher.
Kelly.
And we couldn't use it. What about tracker bikes?
So it all went wrong in the 80s. You made bad choices in the 80s.
It turns out Charlie Kelly made a bad choice because the guy him and Gary Fisher put to trademark the word mountain bike didn't know his arse from his elbow and didn't trademark it properly. So Charlie Kelly and Gary Fisher could be making half a dollar each every time someone says the word or sells something with the word mountain bike on it. But their guy cocked up. He's probably just a guy who lived in a hut and grew things in the mountains rather than a proper trademark lawyer.
So we can blame a lawyer and the 80s. These sound like justifiable things to blame for everything being wrong today.
Can you imagine how all the magazines would have evolved? How many magazines has there been in the last 30 years that were MTB? Would it have been ATB UK? Would that have the same ring as MB UK?
Umbook. Who are those two brothers who made annoying tunes with big three brothers with big fringes? What are they? Mbop. Mbok.
Hanson.
Hanson, yeah.
Wow.
I got there. That was like some kind of vocal charades.
Do we need another name though? Wild cycling, all terrain bike, all terrain cycling.
Tracker bikes. Everyone had one of those in the 80s.
I had
off road cycling. It seems to me, weirdly, that gravel riding is basically what most mountain bikers do. You know, if you think about what the terrain that you're riding on, gravel biking, you know, we see that currently the definition of that is a drop barred bike that's totally unsuitable where riding somewhere that a mountain bike could be much more comfortable to be. But it seems to be that I think that most of our riding that we generally do could be called gravel or something.
Flat bar gravel.
If mountain biking was meant to be easy, there's two words in its name it shouldn't be there: mountains and biking. You know, so if you're riding a gravel bike off-road, it's a road bike with chunky tires. That's challenging, and I'm a big fan of inappropriate cycling, whether that be because you've been to the pub or because you're out of shape or your bike is completely inappropriate.
So we've got another option now. We've got inappropriate cycling. That's Charlie's suggestion for how we rename.
That's what everyone thinks we do.
Yeah, everybody. Well, that's the problem, is it? Everyone thinks that what we do is inappropriate. Cross-country riding, off-road cycling. I hate the word cycling. It just reminds me of people in plaid knickerbockers with a flat cap with riding. It's just me then.
Oh yeah.
and your wildest dreams.
Yeah.
Yes. Riding.
No, I don't like bikers to describe mountain bikers, just because you think of leather-clad, beardy people who ride motorbikes.
Mm. On your own time, you can do that.
Yeah. I mean, when I started riding bikes, here we go, back in my day, back in the day, and Chips can relate to this, I think. When I started mountain bike, on my tracker bike, the first mountain bike I had has a 71-degree head angle. If we rode it now, it'd be worse than a gravel bike. But it was mountain biking, as it was still called back then, for me was all about just going across the country to get to places that I could get to quicker than if I walked, or to places that I couldn't actually walk to. Rather ashamedly, you can kind of sum it up as kind of like, it was like an extension of rambling. You know, it's just that it was a tool that allowed me to go into the countryside further than I could walk. That's what mountain biking was. Now, when I think about what I did in Utah, see what I'm doing here, I'm just bringing it all the way around. When I did what I did in Utah, what we did, we got to places that the most exciting part of that riding was the views that it gave us, the fact that I got out there into a landscape that I would not have been able to walk to. And that is kind of mountain biking for me. I like doing the, you know, the jumps and the, you know, the bike park stuff, but mountain biking as it was 20, 25, 30 years ago was about taking you to new places. It was not necessarily about the thrill of the ride. It was about where you could go.
Chips told me when we were chatting downstairs at Single Track a few years ago that the bicycle was voted the most important invention ever in the history of humankind because we got to have sex in the next valley. I think that was the gist of it. Chips will elaborate in a second, but I think it changed the nature of the human race because we started breeding outside of our immediate area.
Allowed us to spread our seed to the other valleys. Is that what you're basically saying?
So you had fun because you got to...
I think that's the basis of a book by Carlton Reid about how the bicycle allowed people to meet other folk from more than 5 miles away and not just on market day once a month. So it was it allowed freedom. It allowed ladies to ride to another village, allowed young gentlemen to explore, and sometimes they met up and there was greater diversification.
Mark, separately, you could be getting a lot more than a view.
Well, I see where you're going. That's not why I did it, though. But yes, I get what you mean.
But all of these things are fun. And they are selling bikes and riding bikes on the basis of fun consequences rather than trying to beat people into riding bikes to work or whatever because that's better for the environment or it's cheaper than driving in or whatever. And it seems to me that as well as being good for mountain biking, like getting more people into riding off-road and enjoying it is a really good way to get people to ride bikes generally. And if you look at... there's a thing called the Bicycle Association, which is the trade body that bicycle brands pay to be part of. And that's the bit that does lobbying for government. And it's done some stuff for mountain biking, largely on e-bike regulations. It's kind of dry but important. But really, their focus is on utility cycling, which, you know, makes sense given climate crisis and everything. But in terms of getting kids onto bikes, they look at bikeability, which is effectively giving kids all the ingredients that they need to be able to ride a bike, like how to actually ride a bike, but not actually telling them why they might want to. Because it's the skills to then go and survive on the road, basically.
Allowed to ride as well.
Where they're allowed, you know, how to do hand signals, all that kind of stuff. But it doesn't make you think, yes, like I could go out and play in the woods or I could go out and play with my friends or whatever. It's just, I likened it to being giving somebody all the ingredients for a pie rather than giving them an actual tasty pre-cooked pie. And perhaps if the Bicycle Association was to do things like lobby for pump tracks to make pump tracks or urban trails to be as common as skate parks and swings and slides, then kids would go out and ride on this stuff from the beginning. So yes, they'd still need to be taught like how to do hand signals on the road and when you've got right of way and that kind of stuff, but they wouldn't need to be taught how to pedal, how to set off, how to ride one-handed, because they'd be doing all that stuff because it's fun, because they'd have learnt it in the same way that they go and learn to swing on a swing and slide down a slide. So yeah, I think there's a real trick being missed in the selling of bikes as fun, and instead we have this whole like media rhetoric about bloody cyclists and lycra louts and worthy green eco warriors and that kind of thing.
I'm going to go around the table now because I'm going to try and sum this up now, because we've been talking for quite a while. Yeah, we've had some rambling sort of opinions going on here in a good way. But I just want to go around and just ask each of you a question. I just want a yes or no answer. And the question is, Hannah, does mountain biking have an image problem?
Yes, it's invisible.
Charlie, does mountain biking have an image problem?
Yeah. I think it's not as cool as skating and surfing, and it's not as desirable. And people pay money to dress up as skaters and surfers and never do it. No one pays to pretend to be a mountain biker.
Chips, does mountain biking have an image problem?
I will say not really, but it doesn't really have enough of an image to have a problem.
And one, just going around then, trying to sum things up. Hannah, if mountain biking has an image problem, whose problem is it?
Brands.
How are they going to fix that? What's the message in a couple of sentences that you would send to brands to get them to rethink their strategy?
I really think that they need to start using the Bicycle Association to further mountain biking or mountain biking adjacent type activities. Yeah.
Right. I think we'll probably bring that to a close there. I kind of agree with you, Hannah. I think the industry itself has got a lot to do here, and I think needs to be a bit of a realization that where the actual, because these things are always commercial, as Charlie will say, where the money actually is not where the image is. And I think it would benefit everybody if there could be a bit of rebalancing of that middle ground that we keep saying nobody's actually focusing on. How they do that, I've got no idea.
Well, and I do think we must recognise all those volunteers that are doing fantastic jobs in local trail associations. And they could do even more fantastic jobs if they had the funding to support it, or central funding to support it or whatever. But yeah, ultimately, they are volunteers, and it will be hard-won battles because it's always going to be in their spare time. And that's why I think really the responsibility comes back to the brands to step up.
Yeah, I love that analogy or that example you quoted before of as you said, in America, taking out local representatives, local, you know, important people, and getting them on bikes and going, look, this is it. I think maybe a bit of that could happen here. You could go to local councils and get the right people and go, come on, let's go and take you out for a ride. Let's show you what it actually is. Mm. And if the actual people, the decision makers, could see mountain biking for what it actually is and not what the perception is, then maybe access to facilities and that public image that there is about mountain biking could be changed. On that note...
And Lycra.
Lycra.
Lycra does not help. Naked Lycra, uncovered Lycra. Lycra without a baggie over it does not help anyone.
To be fair, there's not a great deal of it around in mountain biking these days, is there?
It's definitely moving in the right direction.
So your goal, Charlie, I think we can sum you up as saying that what you think the industry should do is try and get people to want to look like mountain bikers.
Yeah, we mountain biking outfits should be a nice plaid shirt, some cut-off jeans, match it up with some skate shoes, and just sort of, you know, make it a look that you kind of that you want.
About you just wear whatever you like?
That works too, but, you know, I don't think anyone... Kids don't grow up going, oh, I want to look like that. People want to look like Hells Angels. People want to look like skateboarders. People want to look like But no, mountain bikers. I think it comes down to. Let's try and summarize this. If mountain biking was a boy band, we wouldn't make the cut for the Eurovision Song Contest.
If mountain biking was a band, who would it be? Coldplay.
Apparently, one of my neighbours used to be in Embrace. I was like, who the hell's that? So maybe Embrace.
When I was in Utah, I don't know whether I've mentioned this, that I went to Utah last week.
Nice. Yeah, what was the weather like?
Did you go to Utah?
Yeah, it was really nice. I went to Utah. Did I not say that? I mean,
tell us.
Is it very much like Sheffield?
It is. It's a bit like Sheffield, but with more sun. But one of the journos there came up to me and said, I love that shirt. Where do I get that shirt? Guess which shirt I was wearing, Charlie?
Oh, I love to think it was a single track shirt.
Was it indeed.
Was it a t-shirt or was it the Club Ride shirt?
It was the Club Ride shirt.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So the Club Ride shirts are a nice plaid shirt available in a single track merch store. And the technical riding gear, but you can walk into a pub and not look like some kind of neon Olympic dick.
Or
and
a mountain biker.
And we import them from America, so we do should have seen them before.
Yeah. So there we are. How about that to finish on for a segue? Go and check out our range of clothing that Charlie's got on available in our single track shop, because you can dress not like a mountain biker in single track gear. And maybe that's our small contribution to improving the image of mountain biking.
I have one last contribution. Right at the top end of all of this, we mentioned Beer 52. And I didn't know I didn't have the discount code to hand, but basically go to www.beer52.com/singletrack and there's a free case of beer.
There you go. That's how you do it. Go and do it. And on that note, that's where we'll leave it. Until next time, folks, tune in again for another Single Track podcast. This is me, Mark, signing off.
Have a good time all the time, Charlie.
This is me, Chips, waving goodbye.
And I am going to sulk off because I didn't get beer with a beer podcast. So bye from Hannah.
Just missed, Charlie, was that Hannah thought it was 4:25 and it turns out she was looking at a photograph of a clock.
A photograph of a screenshot, yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.